Yes, welcome everyone. My name is Jeff Broom with the Army Corps of Engineers out of Huntsville, Alabama. I'll be your moderator for the 2019 Military Munitions Support Services webinar series. We'll be hosting three webinars this year. Today is the first one. The second one we'll be hosting is on April 3rd. It'll be Lessons Learned and Issues with the RAO Tool by Dr. Perry Meyer. And on September 18th, we'll be doing CWM response with the hosted by the NAOC. The webinar on April 3rd is out for registration. We have not yet got the September 18th ready for registration yet, but I'll be sending out emails, and you can keep checking back on the CLUINS website for when that one comes out. Today's session is only going to be probably about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes. Give or take, so we won't be taking any breaks in the middle, so make sure you're ready to go through the whole session. And with that, what I'll do is turn this over to Dr. Jordan Alderson and Dr. William Coyle, who will be doing the presentations today.
Well, perfect. Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate the introduction. As obviously you know by the title, Ed and I today are going to be presenting on the Munitions Response CLAP Toolkit, Module 1, the Remediation, Investigation, and Feasibility Study. This document, actually, that we're be presenting on is a product of the Intergovernmental Data Quality Task Force, that's the IDQTF. This is a group that's actually chaired by EPA's Federal Facility Restoration Reuse Office and OSD. And this document actually was created by a work group that had representatives from DOD as well as EPA and state regulators. And so we were able to pull together a good team of folks to really be able to represent what would be needed in a CLAP for the RFS carrying things forward. And you'll see also that we call it a toolkit. And we call the document a toolkit because this is just module one that talks about RIFS, and I'll talk about this a little bit more sort of to the end of the presentation, but we're actually going to be developing module two, which will be addressing the RA phase of investigation. And that will be heavily based upon what we put together for the AGC CLAP, but walking through sort of the same examples that we actually have in the Module 1 document. The other thing that's beneficial about this being a toolkit is it gives us the opportunity to also publish other useful documents for the development and in the process of doing munitions response investigations, such as fact sheets and white papers. In fact, we're working on a white paper now as an example that will assist with the use of VSP, a visual sample, which actually we'll talk about a little bit as we kind of go through some of this training. So the purpose of today's training is really to focus on the planning process for putting together a CLAP. So, you know, the toolkit, module one that we're going to be talking about, is very, very heavily based on an example. In fact, we creatively called it Camp Example. But what we're going to be presenting on today is actually, you know, we'll use pieces from that example to kind of illustrate what we're talking about. We're really focused on the planning phase for the investigation. So we'll go into all the planning steps and processes and what should be accomplished in all those planning meetings as you're actually going through the document. An important thing to note is that the example that we base the CLAP on is a complex example that is handled in phases. And so you'll hear Ed and I say this multiple times through the training. Your example, your actual site might be less complex. And so you can actually utilize, you can actually combine some of these planning sessions that we're going through. And it's, in most cases, depending on the size of your site, advisable to do so. But it's much, much easier, as you can imagine, to have a complex example that you can simplify versus having to take a simple example and apply it to a complex site, which is why we went through this process. So in the course of going through the planning session, we're going to be talking about a number of the CLAP worksheets that that will be addressed and when they'll be addressed in the planning phase and the type of information that you'd expect to see on those. And so you can see here a listing of those, obviously Worksheet 10, which addresses the conceptual site model, Worksheet 11, which goes through the data quality objectives, Worksheet 12, which talks about the measurement performance criteria, and just so everyone's on the same page, the measurement performance criteria are those quality control and quality assurance checks that are directly related to your data quality objectives, such that if you have a problem with the measurement performance criteria, it will influence your ability to use the data, and that will be addressed in data usability assessment. We'll also talk about the Worksheet 17, the sampling design and project workflow, as well as the measurement quality objectives, which is other quality control criteria that you can actually recover from that are not as closely tied to the data quality objectives if those do happen to fail. And then we'll wrap up by talking through the data usability assessment, which is, you know, really obviously a key part of this process. That's really where you, and we'll talk more about this, but it's really where you look through what you established and the questions you try to answer initially and go back and see if you can actually answer those questions through the collection of data that you occurred. So some highlights of the toolkit, right? There are some, there is some introduction of some new terms and approaches and QA/QC procedures applicable to munitions response projects. And, you know, so because some of these approaches and quality control criteria are different from existing documents, we are working with the authors of those documents to have them updated, and they will be updated to be consistent with within the MR class. So, for example, the EM200-1-15 document will be updated, as well as NASDAQ guidance, to be consistent with what we have in this document. And the terms that we're talking about, and you'll hear Ed and I mention this as we go through the training, is we use HD and LD for high density and low density areas, and then HUA and LUA for high use area and low use area, as well as non-impacted area. And so those kind of terms you'll see sort of updated in those documents, as well as the approaches that we've laid out in QC criteria that are specified in the document. And so, like I said, you're going to hear this by multiple times from Ed and I today. You know, what we've laid out in this document is for a complex site. It could very well be that the site that you're working on, the site that you eventually work on, is going to be simpler, and a lot of the steps we talk about can be combined into one meeting or a couple of meetings instead of having as many as we've laid out sort of going forward. But all the objectives that we've laid out in these meetings really obviously need to occur in the planning process, where the team comes together and reaches consensus on these things going forward. And that's critical. And another point I want to mention, and we've gotten some feedback on this, and I don't want anybody to be confused about this, but not all of the meetings that we're discussing and planning meetings that we're discussing have to take place face-to-face. Other tools can be used. You can have telecons or any other tools can be used as long as you're reaching consensus and the group is on the same page going forward. And so the agenda for the training today, Ed's going to walk you guys through the overview of the planning process. Then we're actually going to break it down step by step. I'm going to walk through session one that really talks about assembling the preliminary CSM and defining objectives, and then I'll talk about determining data needs and intended uses, which is session two. Ed will then walk through sessions three, four, and five, which talk about developing the technical approach and NPCs, developing the sampling design, and then I'll sum us up by going through sessions five and six, which really focus on updating the sampling design for HD and LD area characterization, and then talking through the data usability assessment. And with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Ed to walk us through that planning process overview.
Okay, thank you so much, Jordan. And again, thanks to Jeff and Jean for the opportunity and for setting this up for us. We really appreciate it. So the MRQAP worksheets will be completed in a series of project planning sessions. And worksheet 9 is the place where we document those planning sessions. And this worksheet is where you're going to record participants, the key decisions or agreements that you reach during those meetings, and any action items that might come from those as well. So multiple planning sessions typically are going to be conducted to complete, especially a complex QAP as we have in our example here. And those sessions should involve key technical personnel and decision makers that are needed for that specific stage of planning and documentation. So specifically, as Jordan mentioned, we're going to be reviewing the project planning to actually populate the worksheets 10, 11, 12, 17, and 22. And we'll go over those in detail in just a moment. So these scoping sessions may be very early in the planning process, and it might just be with the DoD and the regulators, or it can involve internal planning. And what I mean by that is maybe it's just with the DoD and their contractor as well. As Jordan mentioned, planning sessions can be by phone, by web conferencing, or face-to-face. We know that it's very often very, very difficult to get people into the same room because we all have more than one site to go through. So certainly use as many options as you can for these planning sessions and to document the DCO development process. Many project teams actually utilize meeting minutes as well, and they can be just included in the appendix of the CLAP as necessary. So this module, Module 1, illustrates a phased investigation requiring multiple planning sessions throughout the RIFS phase. Camp example was intentionally designed to be fairly complex, and that was to cover as many CSM scenarios as possible for the potential users. So if you have a site that is not as complex, some of these steps can be combined or perhaps even eliminated, depending upon your conceptual site model. So here on slide 6, these next few slides are really intended to sort of be an overview of what we have set up in Worksheet 9 and the project planning process. Jordan and I will then be going into more detail for each one of these planning sessions and activities that goes on through each and every one of those. This particular slide is a screenshot from the process flowchart that's in worksheet number 9, and it helps the project team basically to sort of visualize the activities that are performed as part of the example provided and where you are at each stage of the investigation. So it's basically a roadmap, and it makes it a lot easier to follow the strategy. So each project planning session or activity is shown, the participants, the general objective or activity that occurs in each session, and the output. Initial project planning will establish separate data quality objectives for the preliminary MRS characterization, which is sort of the first step, and that involves delineating the high density and the low density areas, characterizing the HD areas, and then followed by characterizing the LD areas. So separate DQOs for these three steps are needed because typically the objectives, the data needs, and the data collection and uses may also be different. So in this particular slide, we're looking at two planning sessions. And in our example, the contractor, as you can see, hasn't been selected yet. And these meetings were designed, these preliminary meetings were designed to really discuss the conceptual site model and the very preliminary DCO steps. Now, we did this as a group. We did it by design because often the planning sessions are necessary to actually develop an informed request for quote for the contractor. So then, after the contractor is selected, the project team may revisit these steps with the contractor involvement doing our heavy lifting, of course. So these particular steps will go through DQO steps 1 through 4. And again, each project is different, so the participants may be different. Some planning sessions may be combined or may not even be required, or perhaps there might be different outputs depending, again, on your particular site and your particular conceptual site model. Next, the contractor now has, as you can see, has been selected, and the contractor helps us do the heavy lifting for the later phases of the DQO development, where we have our sampling design, our measurement performance criteria, and our MQOs. So in planning session 3, for camp example, the project team will first revisit and solidify the initial DQO outputs, that's steps 1 through 4, developed in our initial sessions that I just showed you earlier, sessions 1 and 2, before proceeding to the subsequent DQO steps of 5 and 6. And that's where we have our decision rules and our MPC development. In session 4, the project team will agree on the sampling design. That's our DQO step 7, which is documented in worksheet 17, to plan the transect data, the collection parameters that will be used in VSP to first characterize the MRS. The outputs will also include the MQOs that are needed, and that's going to be documented in Worksheet 22. So in our example, the CLAP is finalized by the project team at the end of project session number 4. However, you're going to see there's 2 additional planning sessions that are included for the purposes of discussing the preliminary findings and adapting the sampling design for future phases if needed. So once the CLAP is established, the process is outlined in the toolkit example, utilizes basically 3 steps, these basic steps. You implement, that is, you do your data collection, you conduct the data evaluation, and that's what we call a usability step. and then we update the conceptual site model if necessary, and then review and modify our sampling design, which is worksheet 17, as necessary for the next step. For the preliminary MRS characterization, the first step is to establish a boundary between the low and the high density areas, and we use VSP as our tool to do that. At the end of this HDLD delineation, the project team will revisit the sampling design, that's worksheet 17, for the next step, which is going to be the HD area characterization. After the preliminary characterization, we perform an interim DUA, that's a data usability assessment, and we revise the conceptual site model as part of delineating the HD and LD areas. Now, remember that just because an area has been found to contain high density anomalies, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily munitions related, and that's why we have the HD characterization. So, at the end of the preliminary MRS characterization, our outputs are the VSP data outputs and the updated conceptual site model delineating the high density and the low density areas. So on slide 9, there we go. So for a phase investigation, project planning session 5 is the next iteration of the implementation of the QAP. Now that the HD and the LD areas have been delineated, the project team can proceed to the next step, and that is to characterize the high density areas. We also place buffer zones at this time. As Jordan mentioned, we have some new terminology that's part of the toolkit, and you'll notice at the very beginning of this toolkit, there's a glossary and also some definitions that will help you define some of these. So the buffer zone, which is placed in the LD area, is around a high use area and accounts for the uncertainty in determining that HUA boundary. And it provides a buffer, as the name implies, between an HUA and any adjacent non-impacted area, that's the NIA. And this is a conservative step that gives us added confidence in our delineation. On slide 10, so the final project planning step in the toolkit is to revisit the sampling design and agree on further data collection for characterization of the low density areas, if in fact that's needed. At the end of planning session number 6, the project team will revisit the conceptual site model and ensure that the sampling design for the LD area characterization basically is still on target. That is, we haven't found anything new based upon our early investigations that would change our conceptual site model drastically. In most cases, an LD area characterization is actually going to be based upon pre-existing data. So in summary, project planning in the toolkit example is a stepwise process, and although the worksheet 11 DQOs are established early during project planning, we revisit that conceptual site model and sampling design before we proceed with each of the three sampling events. And that's, again, the HDLD area delineation, and then characterizing the HD areas and characterizing the LD areas. The overall theme here, and you will notice, the overall theme here is plan, implement, DUA, or that data usability assessment, and then affirmation of our conceptual site model. And then we proceed to the next step. Okay, so that's sort of the 30,000-foot overview of the project planning steps in the toolkit. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Jordan, who's going to go through and give you more specifics on planning steps 1 and 2 in more detail.
Perfect. Thanks, Ed. So Ed went through that large overview, and this is something I don't want to sort of escape anyone's attention. The first two planning sessions, and I'll talk through both planning session 1 and planning session 2, occur with just the lead agency and the regulators. So this is for you to focus on the fact that if you're going to put out something for solicitation, this is the information you're going to need to do that successfully. Okay, so are you going to complete, as you see, the outputs are worksheet 10 and worksheet 11? No, they don't have to be completed, but you need enough information for this information so that you can actually pull the solicitation together. And having the regulator involved in this phase right, prior to solicitation actually sets you up for significant success. And so as I walk through what you do in planning session one and planning session two, think about the fact that this is information you need to pull together so that you can effectively put something out for on the street for solicitation. So as I said, the outputs are worksheets 10 and 11, the preliminary CSM, DQO steps 1 and 2. So if you're looking what you're pulling together, so the conceptual site model, this is just should be an overview for you guys, but it's a working iterative model depicting current understanding of sources, pathways, and receptors. A lot of this information, if not all of it, should come from previous investigations, right? So from the SI, you should have the information, so you should be able to pull this stuff together, okay? And I always look at the entire project, essentially, as completing the conceptual site model, right? So you start off with this conceptual site model, and as you gain and gain and gain information, it actually just becomes what the information you have for the site is, right? It's no longer conceptual and it's no longer a model. It is the information that you have for the site. And so you'll see, right, the type of things that you'll need is the facility profile, right? So site location, size of facility uses, previous investigation findings, right? Physical profile, what's the geology, the topography, right? Release profile, right? What was the MEC use was stored or disposed of? What kind of distribution do you expect to see on the site? And like I said, the working version of the CSM should be updated throughout the project. Ed mentioned this as well, right? As you get information, it keeps on feeding into the CSM to get you the information you need. And you can imagine if you don't have this information, how could you possibly put a solicitation out on the street? So stacking hands on this with a regulator prior to putting the solicitation together makes complete sense. So this is just a graphical demonstration taken from the template, the toolkit, from Camp Example, something that would serve as part of your conceptual site model. And you'll see here, right, that this shows the number of bombing targets and a couple of range fans just making sure that everyone's on the same page and agrees as to what was there and what you're investigating to determine obviously makes a lot of sense. And you're also going to see things in here like the areas where you have issues of the rights of entry, those little red squares. You probably can't easily read necessarily the key on this, but those are areas where you don't have right of entry. Why wouldn't you, if you know this prior to going in the planning phase, try to address this with the regulatory agencies and ensure everyone's on the same page with what you're going to do about the fact that that's an already known gap in information going forward. What limitations and issues would that have as you sort of investigate the study? And, you can, like I said, work around that and plan for that, obviously, in the early phases of an investigation. You'll also see here, and this is a bit of an eye chart, so I apologize, and the goal here really isn't necessarily to read through this entire table, but this is table one that we took out of the camp example for MRSA from the toolkit. But the type of information that's sort of listed here, right, it should include information like the type of munition and the current future receptors. That type of information in this type of a format is what you're looking to pull together for your CSM initially. And that sort of leads us to this point of once you've got that CSM information together, this is another important step that you need to accomplish sort of prior to putting this on the street for solicitation. And that is defining the question you're going to answer with the investigation. This really should serve as the basis for what the solicitation is, right? We want to do an investigation to answer these questions. And you can see sort of through this, you can read through what we have here for the problem statement. I wasn't going to read through the entire thing, but it's this concept of everyone reaching, the regulator and the DoD reaching consensus on what are the goals of this study? What are we trying to show and what are we trying to prove here? The wording choice is very important. The rest of the DQOs and, all the scope of the investigation are based on this problem statement, right? Everything sort of flows from this. This really does serve as the foundation for your house. And actually, when we talk about the data usability assessment, really what you're checking at the very end is, did I collect appropriate data to be able to answer this question, to answer the question of the problem that's stated here? And so it's really, really critical that you pull this information together and the kind of words that you use. And so the final thing that you're going to be pulling together in planning session one, the way we've outlined it in this template, would be DQO step two. And these are identifying the goals of the data collection, And this is you breaking apart, essentially, the problem statement into digestible pieces. And so I always look at this as the way to sort of eat the elephant, right? So how do you eat the elephant? You cut it up into smaller pieces. And so you break down that sort of problem statement into these principal study questions. And you'll see, you know, and define the alternative outcomes. So you'll see the principal study question, examples like what are the nature and extent, horizontal and vertical distribution of explosive hazards at MRSA and MRSB? What are the current potential future threats, future that may be posed to human health and the environment by MEC remaining at the site? What are alternative actions for mitigating current and potential threats if identified, posed by MEC remaining at the site? And so these are just examples of you chopping this up, like I said, into smaller pieces so that you can actually address it. And once again, these all stem directly from that problem space. So planning session two, like planning session one, happens prior to solicitation. And, you know, like I said initially, together these two planning sessions generate the information that you usually need for the to prepare the solicitation. And so once again, these are, alphas are going to be worksheet 11, steps 3 and 4. And what you'll see is we're not going to completely fill in all the details in worksheet 10 or all the details or go completely through the DQO process. All we're doing is really triggering these initial steps that you would need, that the information you need, so you can properly prepare that solicitation. So step three, the DQO process, is sort of the next thing you'll do in this planning session, and that's identifying information needed to fill the data gaps in the CSM and answer the study question. Okay, and so what you have here is you have here's some example. So the information needed to establish presence and absence of MEC and characterize potential hazards, right? So for example, background densities, target area densities, type and distribution of MEC. You'd want to, you know, obviously the information needed to establish exposure potential, so current and future land use, who are the receptors and the exposure scenarios, and information needed to support the FS if necessary, right? Cost effectiveness, practicality of alternatives. These are things that you really should be obviously pulling together for step three. And in step four, really what you're doing here is you're specifying the target population. This is really defining the boundaries of the project, right? So you're going to specify the target population and characteristics of interest, define spatial and temporal boundaries, right? So in this example, you can see we've got the target population includes any ordnance used, stored, or discarded at camp example, including UXO and DMM. The target population also includes MD, which serves as an indicator of potential MEC hazards and potential munitions constituent contamination. Table 11-1 will list munitions that are known or suspected to be present at camp example. And so this is sort of an example of the kind of things you would want to see in step four of the process. And so table 11-1 will have, you know, this type of information, like the known or suspected munitions. So, you know, what the munitions are, including nomenclature, UXO and versus DMM, potential hazard and severity, right? What kind of munitions are there and what can we expect? Expected fragmentation distance, detection depth, approximate diameter, and approximate length of the material. And so all of this stuff that I just talked through, right, walking through what you put in for the CSM, and this point of DQO development is what you would need to then move on to the full point of solicitation. So this would be, so, you know, what we're telling you is this information really, having consensus on this from the regulator and the DoD project manager, and then moving on from here to solicitation really does set you up for success. And that would move you into the next planning session, which is planning session three. And for this, I'll turn it over to Ed. Ed?
All right. Thanks, Jordan. So for those of you that are following along, I'm now going to move on to slide 21. So Jordan has started separating the elephant for us a little bit and moving on to planning session three. So we've moved through session one and two where we've finalized DQO steps one and four. Those are complete, and the team has agreed on the conceptual site model, the problem statement. The very important part of that is really that problem statement, and the necessary inputs for the investigation. So the next logical step is to develop the technical approach, and that's DQO step number five. So assuming nothing has changed and the DQO steps one and four are still good, we define our measurement parameters and establish our decision rules for how the data will be used, and then the measurement performance criteria, those are the MPCs, that are needed for the data in order to use them in those decision rules appropriately. So these are the MPCs that we document in QAP worksheet number 12. So for each step of the RIFS, again, the preliminary MRS characterization, the HD area characterization, and then the LD area characterization, we list the parameters of interest, and that's the data that we're going to collect. For example, for our transect surveys, for the preliminary MRS characterization, the parameters would be anomalies exceeding a project-specific detection threshold, signal-to-noise ratio, background anomaly density, and average target area density above background. Again, I know some of these are inputs for VSP, and if they're confusing to you, again, we do have some definitions at the front of the document. So the key assumptions, that is the VSP inputs that we're going to use in this first step, are also going to be defined here in planning session number 3. So the type of inference that we define here would be define the HD areas, that's the potential high use areas, as those where the anomaly density is greater than or equal to a user-defined critical density that we use in VSP, and LD areas is those areas having an anomaly density less than that user-defined critical density. And finally, the decision rules are developed that summarize how those parameters, those assumptions, and types of inference will be used in making a specific decision. For example, using the data to delineate the HD and the LD areas, the HUA, the LUA, and the NIA as well. So moving on to slide 23, in our camp example, phase planning may not be applicable to all sites, as Jordan has mentioned before. So for example, a preliminary MRS characterization may not always be necessary. If the locations of your targets are very well documented, you have a very solid SI, and as reflected in all that work that you put into that preliminary conceptual site model. So all available and relevant lines of evidence for delineation should be used. All historical records that are available to you, historical photos, visual observations and interviews, all those should really be considered. If the project team notes any data gaps in the conceptual site model, then perhaps you may need to do some additional investigation to fill those data gaps. And planning for specific areas that may be needed, or conversely, the HD-LD characterizations might even be able to be performed together. It all depends upon your conceptual site model and the complexity of your site. Designation as a low-use area or an NIA, a non-impacted area, must be made based on the strength of this evidence that all of you together, the entire project team, has put together in the conceptual site model. If that conceptual site model contains evidence of munitions use or presence in, say, an LD area, then it's a low-use area. If the conceptual site model contains sufficient evidence documenting no munitions use in the LD area, then it's a non-impacted area. So the primary objective in characterizing the LD areas to differentiate low-use areas from non-impacted areas. For very small sites with a fairly mature conceptual site model, the project team may not find it necessary to delineate the LD area into a presumed LUA or a presumed NIA. It's going to be a project team decision, and again, emphasize how important it is for every single team to put a lot of work up front during that conceptual site model development. So for each HD area identified during the preliminary MRS characterization, the project team is going to develop a data collection approach in DQO step number 5 to determine whether it's munitions related, and if so, characterize the various populations of anomalies, for example, clusters of specific types of munitions that might be present, and confirm whether the area is or contains a high-use area, and define the HUA boundaries as well. The determination that the sources of all sample anomalies are not MET or MD are consistent with other uses will indicate that the area is likely not an HUA. So obviously, early in the conceptual site model development and filling any data gaps, it's really, really critical at this point. Some example decision rules would be if MEC or MD are identified within a high density area and the conceptual site model indicates munitions were used in that area, then the area will be confirmed as a high use area. And that would be something that the team would agree on. And the team would characterize and then establish a boundary and buffer zone for that particular area. If MEC or MD are identified within the HD area, but the conceptual site model contains no evidence of munitions use, then the project team will determine whether further investigation should be conducted. If no MEC is found, then the team may revisit the conceptual site model and or investigate the area as a presumed low use area or not impacted area, depending upon the conceptual site model. Again, this is a project team decision, and the project team should agree on this up front before moving on to the next step. So what exactly are the criteria? What criteria do we need on the data to be able to utilize them in the decision rules? So that's DQO step number six. And this is where the project team agrees on our MPCs, again, the measurement performance criteria. So I'm sure you've probably heard MPCs described before, and they are the minimum criteria that specified data need to meet in order to minimize the possibility of making an erroneous decision. That is, for example, concluding that a high-use area is a non-impacted area. We don't want to make that error. So MPCs are sometimes referred to as data quality indicators. It's basically the same type of thing, just a different acronym, and represent the qualitative and quantitative specifications for things like accuracy, precision, sensitivity, representativeness, completeness, and comparability. You may have sometimes heard this called PARCs. So these are the parameters that collected data must meet to satisfy the DQOs that are described in the previous steps 1-5. So MPCs guide the development of the sampling design, and that which is developed during step 7, the last step of the DQO process, and documented in worksheet 17. They are also, as Jordan had mentioned earlier, they are really critical because they're the criteria against which our data usability is going to be evaluated at the end of the study. And we're going to document these on worksheet number 12. So the QAP output then will be the population of worksheet number 12. So remember that in the toolkit, as a reminder, green text provides instructions for completing each worksheet. Blue text will give you some examples of the types of information typically needed. Where applicable, minimum recommended requirements contained in the worksheet are presented actually as black text, and project teams must provide rationale for changes to the black text. So a convenient and an efficient way to do this is actually to provide it as an appendix to the project-specific QAP, describing any changes and providing that rationale. You can just attach that to the QAP itself. So this is just a screenshot directly from the toolkit of measurement performance criteria for CAMP example. As you can see, the worksheet has entries for the measurement activity being performed there on the left, and the specific MPC or DQI, if you will, being performed at that particular stage, the performance specification, and finally the assessment activity that summarizes how that performance is being assessed to the stated specification. Remember that MPCs are the minimum performance specifications that basically our IFS need to meet in order to ensure that our collected data will satisfy the DQOs. They are the criteria against which our intermediate and final DUA, our data usability assessments, are going to be conducted. And the final DUA is going to be documented on worksheet 37 that Jordan's going to talk about later. So in short, meeting our MPCs ensures that we have data that can be used for decision making. Failure to meet these MPCs could mean a significant detriment to the overall success of the project. The final data usability assessment is going to evaluate and document the data quality and decision making impacts of any failures to meet these criteria. And again, Jordan will review that in just a little while. So moving on to slide 27, planning session number 4. So now that the next iteration in planning is the final DQS step 7, using the outputs from the previous DQS steps. In this step, an approach for collection of data that will meet project-specific DQOs and MPCs is summarized, and it describes the sampling design and the project workflow in detail, and will involve running the planned transects in VSP. So we're using VSP as our tool here. The VSP outputs are then the transect design for our preliminary MRS characterization. So for RIs conducted in a phased approach, the version of Worksheet 17 contained in the QAP at the start of the investigation will describe a detailed sampling plan for the MRS characterization, and as Jordan mentioned, general approach for the subsequent phases. Results from the preliminary MRS characterization will be used to update the CSM and revise the detailed sampling approach for the HD area and LD area characterizations if necessary. So on slide 28, as previously mentioned, DQOs are summarized on QAP worksheet number 11. And with the final step 7 producing the sampling approach, the completed DQOs now allow us to produce the sampling design for each step. And as I mentioned, the toolkit relies on VSP to provide critical features for that sampling design. Now, VSP is a statistical planning tool, and like any tool, it's dependent upon operational parameters. Those are the input parameters. And those inputs are based upon assumptions that we have agreed upon in step 5. So it's important that the project team understand and agree on those VSP inputs, as they do affect the sampling design. So these should be documented on worksheet number 11, again, as part of DQS step number 7. And there are example tables for the inputs and outputs in our toolkit. So we've included a sampling design workflow diagram in worksheet 17 that will help to tie all the inputs, all the steps, and all the outputs onto one flowchart. So here on slide 29, again, this is another sort of an eye chart, so I apologize that. But so this is a screenshot of the VSP example inputs from our sampling approach for Camp Example. And you'll note again that these are blue text, so these are examples. There are two separate MRS areas in our example, and the conceptual site model for each area is different, and therefore the sampling approach is also different. The training today does not include directions on how to use VSP, and we realize that there is new VSP terminology here. Again, there are definitions at the beginning of the toolkit, and I believe VSP training is being planned at this point. So you'll need to estimate at this step, there's two inputs used in VSP tool in our example here, and that's the background anomaly density and the target area anomaly density. Background and target area anomaly density values are both dependent on the detection system, including the sensor modality, the platform, and the target selection criteria. Background anomaly density is based upon geophysical data for the area and the like. If no prior geophysical data have been collected, the project team will need to agree on an initial background density. So the initial data collected should be used to evaluate whether the planning estimate was correct, and it may be necessary to actually refine the VSP transect spacing if it proves to be inaccurate. Again, it can be sort of a learning curve with these investigations if it's a very complex site. Target area anomaly density should be conservatively selected to represent the smallest or lowest intensity, that is the intensity used, that is the lowest reasonable density of concern at the site. And again, that's to be conservative in our approach. On slide 30, again, you're looking at just a screenshot here of the visual sampling plan output. So the VSP is then used to create a graph of probability of detection versus transect spacing. So appropriate transect spacing is then selected from this graph, that is the maximum spacing for which the graph indicated a 100% likelihood of traversing and locating the target area. In table 11.3 that you see here, the transect spacing, that is the VSP output for the different MRS areas for Camp Example and the associated methods are shown here. So you'll note that the analog spacing is much tighter, and that's because the inputs are different. So moving on to slide 31. So the sampling design and project workflow should include the following items here. So it should include a map showing the physical boundaries for each MRS, the workflow diagram that defines the stepwise activities, and decision paths of the sampling, along with the outputs needed at each representative step. It should include specific descriptions for each definable feature of work, including the required records, the documentation, and or the deliverables. You should also include contingencies in the event field conditions affect sampling design are different than what you would have expected. For example, if a portion of the site is inaccessible at the time that the site work is planned to occur, or the anomaly density is higher than expected. So, and then finally, the sampling design should include points in the process at which our, the lead organization, the regulator, and stakeholder interface might occur, as agreed upon during the project scoping. In slide 32, the session number 4 outputs, and as previously mentioned, the project workflow in our toolkit is designed to illustrate a sampling design for an RIFS that's connected in phases due to the complexity of the site that we came up with different range uses, targets, and conditions, and even conceptual site model data gaps, and thus requiring multiple mobilizations. Again, we did this intentionally to try and cover as many aspects and challenges that project teams may encounter, and that hopefully making our toolkit more useful to practitioners. So the example incorporates the use of both analog and digital technology. For less complex sites, the sampling design should be adapted accordingly. For example, at sites where the locations and uses of targets are well documented during the early phases of an SI, and as documented in a conceptual site model, it may not be necessary to conduct the RI in phases. And the project team may modify the project workflow to accommodate the project-specific sampling design as needed. Worksheet 17 should include the project workflow, which will describe each and every DFW definable feature of work and highlight the government, that is the lead organization or regulatory organization, their inspection, oversight activities, the key deliverables, and the decision points. Again, these are going to be agreed to upfront during project planning. So where applicable, Worksheet 17 should also reference SOPs containing detailed procedures that are going to be used in the course of the investigation as well. Moving on to slide 33. Complexity, as I've referred to it here, especially in our conceptual site model at Camp Example, occurs because of multiple reasons. We have large ranges with multiple uses, and you'll note that there's some non-range activities that we've noted as well. There's different targets and munition types. In some instances, there's lack of historical information, creating some data gaps. There's also challenges with topography and geology as well. So, early planning is key, and we call it a conceptual site model for a reason, and it justifies why a phased approach is really preferred for complex sites, because we learn as we go, and the site model, and therefore our problem formulation, evolves and matures as we go as well. You'll see when Jordan goes over the final data usability assessment later how beneficial it was to use a phased approach and to deal with any conceptual site model challenges and fill data gaps when they were encountered before moving on to the next phase. At the end of Worksheet 17, a detailed sampling design for the first phase at MRS characterization, but the sampling design for the second and third phases are described sort of in general. And after we perform interim data usability assessments, the sampling design for these later phases become rock solid for their intended uses. Any needed updates to the conceptual site model, the DQOs, and any changes to the subsequent sampling design because of that should always be agreed to by the project team, including our regulatory partners, during planning sessions and documented as technical memoranda or perhaps even as Worksheet 17 addenda as needed. It's just a project-specific decision. The important part is to make sure that it is agreed upon and documented. On slide 34, so conversely, many sites may not require a phased approach because the conceptual site model is less complex or more mature because of a well-documented history and/or established data exists from previous investigations. So make sure that the project team, again, including our regulatory partners, agree on that conceptual site model, the problem statement, the BQOs, and our sampling design. The initial MRS characterization step that we utilized in camp example of our toolkit may not be needed for less complex sites because the primary objective of this step was really to delineate the HD and LD boundaries. If those are already well established, then that step really isn't necessary. Also, if there are known target areas without other complications identified during DQO development, then perhaps the HD and LD characterization could be combined into one step. That's also an option. But again, be flexible, and we encourage the project teams to be as flexible as possible and be prepared for changes in the conceptual site model as they occur, which may require additional plan sessions and mobilization. So finally, depending upon the anticipated future land use of the site and the respective activities, it may not be necessary to define the spatial locations of both LUAs and non-impacted areas. Again, it all depends upon the conceptual site model and the complexity of the site. So I'm now on slide 35, and what you're seeing here is basically a canned version of the workflow diagram 17-1 in our worksheet 17, specifically for the preliminary MRS characterization. The workflow should provide concise descriptions for each definable feature of work and highlight the government inspection and oversight activities, the key deliverables or outputs for those steps, and the decision points that were agreed to earlier during project planning. So there's also going to be workflow diagrams for the HD characterization. That's going to be 17-2 and the LD characterization, which is figure 17-3 in our toolkit. So here there are six separate definable features of work in the MRS characterization, starting with the initial site preparation, leading through the setup, the system check, the sensors that are being used, the anomaly selection, and the transect surveys, which lead to the demarcation of the HD and LD areas. Many of these same definable features of work are also going to be used in the other phases of the HD and LD area characterizations as well. So note that there are also periodic process steps after data collection activities to evaluate our measurement quality objectives, and those are MQOs. So have MQOs been met for that particular sampling design, that particular step, and that particular data collection effort? We can come back to these during our data usability assessments as well. Here on slide 36, so what are the MQOs? So this is a screenshot of worksheet number 22, and MQOs are basically the procedures for performing testing, inspections, and quality control for all field data collection activities, and they are documented on this worksheet. So in this screenshot, you'll see that we have examples of field collection activities, MQOs, for the high-density characterization phase. References to the applicable DFW and the related standard operating procedures are included here. As Jordan mentioned earlier, failure response should be included, including a root cause analysis to determine the appropriate corrective action and who the responsible person or party is for performing that corrective action. And that has to be reported, and who is responsible for actually verifying it. So again, as Jordan had mentioned, we can actually recover from MQOs. As a quick reminder, MQOs are similar to MPCs, those measurement performance criteria that we defined on worksheet 12. But MQOs are specific field activities that, again, we can recover from. MPCs are more critical, as they are the minimum performance specifications that the remedial investigation must meet in order to make sure that our collected data will satisfy the DQOs documented in steps 1 through 5 on worksheet 11. So they are the criteria against which the intermediate and final data usability will be conducted as documented on worksheet 37. I led you through session number 4. Now I'm going to turn this back over to Jordan, who's going to take you through the remaining planning session.
Perfect. Thank you, Ed. As Ed said, he got you through session four. And so now I'm going to lead you through sessions five and six, and then actually talk about the usability assessment at worksheet 37. So that leaves us on to slide 37 now, for those following along. So once again, think about this and the fact that, if needed, if you're using a phased RIFS, this planning session, if you remember back to what Ed laid out when he went through the entire sort of process, this is where you're actually going to perform the HD area characterization. So once again, the participants are, lead agency, contractor, and the regulators will be involved. And the outputs will be, and we list this as worksheet 17 addendum. There are lots of ways this can be documented and pulled together, but that's how we did it in our example. You don't have to do it that way, but it is one way in which you can document this information. And what you'll see here is, as I advance the slide, you'll see that workflow diagram that Ed had just shown you, it's a very similar looking workflow diagram for the HD area characterization, right? Where once again, these are the steps you'll be performing. You'll finalize your sample design, site preparation if needed, seed in placement, assemble your sensor, collect some data, do some anomaly selection, data validation. Make sure, like Ed said, that those MQOs were achieved. Then the anomaly source characteristics, and then obviously, determination characteristics if it's for the data usability assessment, and also if it's a high use area characterization. And that sort of brings you in to the information that obviously you would need for the HD area characterization. You'll see that planning session six, we break these out into lots of planning sessions. We understand the concern of that. A lot of this stuff can be combined. Planning session six is for the LD area characterization. And things get a little trickier when you talk about the LD area characterization. Once again, the same folks sort of are involved, the lead agency, contractor, and regulators. You'll be reviewing the HD area characterization report, potentially, including the data usability assessment. But the update of the LD area characterization sample design as needed outputs and potentially a worksheet 17 addendum. And the reason why this becomes trickier than the HD area characterization is that it's when you think about this conceptually, obviously, a low density area, just by its nature, being low density, it's very difficult to collect enough data to make a defensible decision based on what was collected, right? Because there's fewer things out there. So it doesn't really make sense for you to go out there and collect any information. Can you really draw a defensible decision based on the data collected? And some projects will want to do this. We're not saying that they shouldn't, but it is a sort of an important question to consider going forward when doing so. And when looking at an LD area and what you possibly can determine based on this, based on the data collected. And so you'll see the workflow diagram that I just pulled up, really is quite simple. We really don't go through what that data collection is because in our example we determined it didn't really make sense to do so. And here's where you establish the low use area and then the non-impacted area boundaries, right? And then conduct your final data usability assessment. Bringing you sort of into the finalizing the CSM for this sort of phase of the investigation. So like I said, other projects, your project can determine to take and do an investigation in a low density area. It is something to consider though as to how much data you can actually collect and what use that data will be. And this sort of brings you sort of to the sort of end of these planning phases that we sort of discussed. And now will lead us into the discussions for worksheet 37. And so some of this stuff of worksheet 37, and now I'm on slide 41, is things you'd want to document, right, on the worksheet prior to doing the data usability assessment in the planning phases, like who would do what and how that would play out, but also sort of walk through the kind of questions you want to answer. And so I cannot stress enough how important the data usability assessment is, right? So this is where you're actually making the decision if you can actually make the determinations you want to. Did you answer that principal study question the problem statement that we laid out, in step one of the DQOs in the first meeting? Can you answer that question based on what you've done? Is the data good enough to bring you there? And that's really what this process brings you to do. So this is performed by key members of the project team. And so in some instances, you're going to need some technical expertise to go through this and perform this process. It's not just the regulator and the lead agency and the contractor. There's some key folks that you might actually need in the room to help you go through this process. You want to ensure that regulators have an opportunity to review and comment on this usability assessment, because this is really where you're making the case that you can you've sort of completed what you set out to do. It's integrated into the decision-making, and it's conducted in each phase if applicable. So it evaluates, like I said, whether the data support MPCs and DQOs. So Ed and I have spent a lot of time talking about how the fact that these MPCs are closely tied to those DQOs. So you can actually fail an MPC. It will potentially impact your DQO, but it doesn't necessarily mean the project is, you know, the data is unusable. It just means you're going to have to change what that data quality objective is and what the potential ability you have to use that data for its end goal would be. So an example of that would be if you had a depth of detection determination and you assumed or were hoping you were able to see down to a lower depth, but you weren't able to based on site conditions, background interference or whatever it might be. It doesn't mean that you cannot use the data, but it does mean that data cannot be used as you initially intended to the depth that you predicted. So are the underlying assumptions that you made supported? Have sources of uncertainty been managed appropriately? Do data represent the population of interest? Right? Can the results be used as intended with an acceptable level of confidence? Those are really the key questions that you're trying to get to. So I mentioned the key personnel that you're going to want to participate in the UA, and this is just an example of some folks, right? You'd want the RPM, the project manager, the project QA manager, and project geophysicist, or QC geophysicist, or field geophysicist. All of those folks, they may or may not be necessary, not for every piece of the data usability assessment, but they probably will be for some of it. And that's something you're going to want to include. And you're going to want to identify the documents and records required as the data usability assessment inputs and describe how the data usability assessment will be documented. How are you going to output that? Is it going to be an addendum? Is it going to be a separate report? Is it going to be just added to the final report? There's lots of ways it can be documented. And so some people like it in a separate report. It doesn't have to necessarily be. So here are the steps of the data usability assessment process, right? So initially, you've got to review those DQOs. As I said, those are the foundation for everything you're doing. And in a data usability assessment, what you're doing is you're going back to those DQOs and ensuring, were the underlying assumptions valid, right? Were the review the sampling design, if it might, were VSP inputs representative? Ed had a little bit and had showed a little bit about VSP, but you're making some assumptions with VSP about background density, about, you know, so all that information that you've put into VSP, you know, were they valid? Now, they don't have to be exact to what you initially predicted. When you do the study, you might find different information, but will it impact the data? Is it still representative, right? Summarize the deviations and describe your impacts on the DQOs. Because nothing, your assumptions initially aren't going to always be perfect, but they might have minimal to no impact on the DQOs, or they might have an effect, and you're going to have to address that in the usability assessment. Then you're going to review data verification validation outputs and evaluate conformance to MPCs. So if you did have any QC failures, did they go through the root cause analysis process correctly and corrective action process, and were they effective? And do data gaps remain? Are there places where you don't have data? And if you do have these data gaps, Can you still make the decisions you want to make with these gaps in your data? And in some cases, you obviously can. In some cases, you can't. You might have to recollect, or you might have to make the best decisions you can with the data collected. So that sort of wraps up what the usability assessment will sort of get you, really pull you into. And it's, like I said, it's critically important part of the process for you to go through the data usability assessment. And get that relative information that you'll need to be able to determine if you can make the decisions you want to make. So some next steps that I thought I'd sort of mention here, so not only has this training been offered, we're actually also working on developing a 2-day training course on Module 1 that will be taken throughout the EPA regions, maybe not all the regions, but we're planning on taking it out starting this calendar year. That process was slowed down a little bit by the government shutdown, but we're still obviously making headway to develop that course. That course will be a little bit more hands-on, obviously, than what we have in the webinar, and really sort of walk through the thought process and decision-making as we kind of go through that going forward. And as I mentioned sort of initially, we are looking to update the to update the AGC QAP and turn it into module 2 of the of the toolkit. And so that initially that thought process was we would just update the AGC QAP and get it to be a little bit more include other technologies. But the work group felt really strongly, and I think it was a wise decision for us to sort of update the AGC QAP to actually follow through with some of the examples that we actually walked through in module 1 and bring them through completions of the RA phase of investigation. And so those are sort of some of the next steps that we're playing out with some of the with some of the activities that we've got ongoing. And so somehow that slide kind of got out of order, but step 3 of the data usability process, which I obviously didn't cover, so I apologize, documents the data usability, update the CSM, and draw your conclusions, and really focus on can the data be used as intended? Are the data sufficient to answer the study question? Document the lessons learned and make recommendations. Summarize those lessons learned and make recommendations for future investigations, and prepare the data usability summary report, which, like I said, sort of initially can be either part of the same document or a separate document, depending on how you want to break it out. And right, like I said, this is really, like I said, it's critical because it's where the rubber meets the road. This sort of step of updating that CSM and really finalizing it in this phase is obviously critical going forward. So in summary, you know, project planning process is flexible. So like I said, I know we've got a lot of feedback on the fact that, you know, some projects are simpler, some projects don't necessarily need to have, these planning processes broken out to the same degree, but all these phases need to be gone through. And all these meetings should occur, but they don't necessarily occur separately, they can be combined, and they can occur in lots of different ways. Module 1 illustrates application to a complex site. Like I said, it can be shortened for a simpler site, and it's much easier to present an example in a complex way and allow people to then modify it to a simpler project than vice versa. The CSM is obviously, you know, and the data usability system are obviously tremendously critical to this whole process, right? I mean, the CSM is an unbelievably valuable tool for decision making, and it should be updated throughout the project, as agreed during the planning process. It really, when you're done, right, it's no longer conceptual and it's no longer a model. It just tells you about the site. And the data usability assessment is critical in the sense that you know, you're actually completing really the DQO process, right? You've laid out all your data quality objectives, and at this phase, you're saying, have I met all of my intended goals? Was I able to answer the principal study question? Was I able to meet all of my data quality objectives and make the decisions I want to make going forward? And so next steps, and this is actually sort of a repeat of that previous slide that I went through, talking about the 2-day course and essentially the update to the AGC QAP, and it gives you kind of an idea and a time frame for that. So that'll be mid-2020 by the time we get Module 2 out is what we're predicting. Just a touch on a few other things. You know, we didn't mention up front, but I serve as the chair of the DoD's Environmental Data Quality Work Group, and obviously Ed serves on that work group as well. And so we've got some obviously significant interaction with obviously development of these documents, but we're also continuing implementation of our of the DoD's Advanced Geophysical Classification Accreditation Program. That's the program that accredits organizations that utilize advanced geophysical classification. Currently, we've got 12 accredited organizations to do so, and so we're going to continue to provide oversight of that, provide some oversight and assistance in the implementation of this document going forward, and continue to monitor the development of advanced classification technology. One of the things that we're sort of committed to, sort of as we look into the future and as we sort of see with AGC development, is we want to ensure that the innovation actually won't be stifled by the systems we put in place. And so we're working closely to sort of ensure that nothing that we put in place really causes any of these any real concerns. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff to sort of provide questions to us for Ed and I to address.
All right, thanks, Jordan. Thanks, Ed. I tell you what, we got a lot of questions, so we're going to be kind of rolling through them. First question is: are worksheets 10, 12, 17, and 22 completed prior to selecting the lead agency contractor?
So, Ed, I'll handle this. The answer is no. As I went through in the initial slides, Really what you're completing, and not fully completing, but really what you're doing is you're populating worksheet 10 and going through the first few steps of the DQO process. Really that's really the what you need to complete before the solicitation. So you're not even completing worksheet 11, and not potentially even fully completing worksheet 10. You're pulling enough information in worksheet 10 to have a good handle on the conceptual site model. And obviously working your way through DQO step 4. And like I said, they don't have to be fully completed this step, but you really need to have consensus on where you are and those big issues associated with them. But I would say having that problem statement defined as well as you can prior to solicitation sets you up for significant success. Remember that a lot of the projects, a lot of the solicitations are sent out as firm fixed price. We really want to make sure that and give the contractors a fair chance to understand what they're bidding on and exactly what we're actually asking them to do, and this is the best way to do it.
All right. Next question is, how are munition constituents addressed in this QAP?
That's a great question. So this document does not address munition constituents. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't be addressed. We feel as though the existing UFP QAP format addresses chemical contamination very well, and that'll be handled in a separate document. We had to make modifications to the worksheets to sort of address, munitions constituents. To address munitions investigation. And so, for that purpose, we think it would be a Herculean task to make one document sort of address both sort of completely. And so, we look at that as having its own and separate document.
All right. Next question. We got a lot of questions, so I'm going to kind of roll through these pretty quick. Are these worksheets available as Word files to download and edit?
So right now, they are not. We don't have them as Word files available. That is something that we can make available. We can make them as Word files to publish. The blank worksheets, I believe, are available on EPA's website as Word files. But that is something that we can look at doing. This actual document, the toolkit itself, is posted on the DENX website. It should be in the web links and resources for this webinar. And so you can download it as a PDF. But we most certainly can look at making a Word version of the document available for people to utilize and make it easier to populate.
All right. Next question. Per EPA G4, quote, the target population refers to the total collection or universe of sampling units to be studied and from which samples will be drawn. Based on that, wouldn't the target population be all anomalies?
So that's actually that's a true statement that comes right out of the G4, where it talks about, when you talk about target populations, you're talking about, you're sampling, let's say, to affect fish population, that would be, fish or animals or whatever it would be defining target populations. What we found in implementing the QAP and QAP guidance is we actually utilize the target population definition to not only focus on what media you're sampling and the range of that sample, but also limiting you to the sort of target analyte or the items that are of concern. And so you can handle that in the target population definition in step four of the DQO process, or you can actually also define that in step 5 and go forward if you want to limit that definition of target population. And so we've sort of used that definition in a couple ways to sort of hem us in and get agreement at that step in the process as to really what we're focusing our attention on going forward.
Yeah, and obviously this is it. I agree, Jordan. Of course, a big component of that, of course, is also how the problem statement is set up as well.
That's correct.
Okay, next question. MMRP RIs are generally conducted the same way. Now that we have the MRQAP, the process is even more standardized. DQOs steps 1 through 4 will almost always be the same. Is there a realistic example when there would be enough of a difference in those steps from the toolkit that would warrant the additional meeting?
So I guess what I would say is if that truly is the case, once again, you know, if you have significant consistency and agreement from the regulators, and this process has standardized itself significantly, I think that would be a tremendous success. If you can, for those sites that are less complex, be able to do so. I can imagine complex sites where it might not be the case, but if it is the case and you can follow through with these steps of the DTO process, well, then the meetings can take place over the phone where, you know, obviously you're just contacting the regulator and getting their buy-in to these standardized processes. I personally think that'll be trickier based on a site variation, but I could be proven wrong, but that would be a win, I think, for everybody if it was and was able to be that consistent. And like I said, all you'd have to do in that situation would be send out, you know, what you think would be the acceptable sort of information for these four steps of the DQO process and get buy-in from the regulator to sort of go forward. Even that check alone, I think, would be beneficial. And if this helps in that process, well, then that's terrific.
All right. I think we already answered this question, but the question was, where exactly do we find this toolkit?
So it is posted on the Denix website, and I do believe that it's in a link to it is in the web links for this webinar as well. It's posted on the Denix Munitions Response website.
Okay. Based off your slide 34, what do you mean by characterize the LB area? The MRQAP Module 1 doesn't have any digging in the LB area.
As I had mentioned, characterization of the LD area occurs following the characterization of the HD area. So boundaries for the high use areas and the buffer zones are already going to be established. So it's really not, first of all, it's really not practical to select any sort of sampling size that's going to be large enough to prove that a low use area or a non-impacted area contains no munitions. So typically, the evaluation of the LD area is going to be based upon pre-existing information. And all that information will be gathered together as part of the conceptual site model. So in many cases, the characterization will not involve any type of field work at all.
Okay. Next question. Which guidance documents will be updated as a result of the publication of the toolkit? This was mentioned earlier in the presentation, but the person didn't get a chance to write them down.
So the main guidance that's obviously utilized will be the EM 200-1-15 document. We're working closely with the folks in the Corps to ensure that there's consistency in what we have in the MRQAP and that document. Currently, I believe the NAFAP folks already referenced the MRQAP Module 1 going forward, and that's really the primary document that will be updated to be consistent.
Okay. How would Module 1 be used for munitions, OB/OD units, and burial sites? BSP is generally not applicable to non-target areas.
So Ed, do you want me to handle this one?
Well, I'm going to allow you to add on because I'm probably not going to help with the latter part of this question. But, you know, certainly the MRQAP is a phased investigative process that can pretty much be used for any site. It's based upon the conceptual site model, and if you appropriately build the problem statement and appropriately go through the data quality objective process, I'm sure that it can also be used for OBOD units and burial sites. I am not a huge expert in BSP, so I can't really address the second part of that question.
Yeah, and so Ed, your answer is obviously almost exactly the same as mine was going to be, which is the document can be modified to do so. I am not convinced that that VSP does have the ability to address those, and so you're going to have to, you know, think about sort of what's the sort of, you know, the bounds of what you're trying to determine and go forward. I know that there is in VSP for its chemical investigation, at the very least, you know, you can sample for determining and identifying and trying to locate hotspots. And I would imagine that disposal area could be considered that way. But that's sort of how you have to investigate it and look at the flexibility of this tool going forward.
All right, we got three more questions in the queue, and then we'll call it a day on them. The next one is on the approval page of the QAP. It states that if analog technology flag approval of the QAP is required, why is used this? Who are those approvers?
So I can address this. So the document does, just to clarify, the document does require if analog technology is utilized, that you need to get a flag officer or equivalent to sign off on the use of analog technology. So the document also contains a white paper that sort of discusses some of the limitations of analog technology. The reason why all this is here is, you know, for those who don't know, back in, I think it was 2001, DOD and EPA released a co-memo that essentially talked about essentially the limitations and concerns of just using analog technology. And even with that letter, we have not seen projects and folks sort of shy away from its use where better alternatives exist. And so the purpose of having that signature on the document is essentially to put projects in a position for ensuring that they can justify the places and times where they need to use analog technology, but also to further put it in a position where its use is really confined to where it only can be, where it's the only technology that can be utilized. And that's why that signature sort of exists, so the government sort of has a good handle on that. I know the Corps has got some policy that exists with contracting and sort of justifying the use of or justifying why you're not using AGC on projects going forward. And this is in that same vein of trying to sort of put that technology in its appropriate box.
Okay, we got the second one here. We got is SOPs were mentioned. Is there a format that the contractor should use for the SOPs?
So, you can answer that.
To directly answer that question in terms of a format, no, there is not. I will emphasize, though, that those folks that are accredited under our program are accredited according to following specific standard operating procedures. Now, part of that program is set up based upon an ISO requirement, and the ISO requirement does stipulate some things that have to be in the SOP. But not really in terms of a standardized format, no. And I also will emphasize, as I mentioned earlier, that the SOP should actually be attached as part of the QAP. And, of course, it's a very important part of the quality assurance aspect of what we're doing because we have to make sure that the processes and procedures are being followed correctly. And that's where that's why it's important to have those SOPs.
Okay. What elements would be impacted if new information shows that additional work is needed after the planning sessions are largely completed? How would a revised QAP be documented?
You could have an addendum and revise the CSM based on information that occurred, and then update the relevant worksheets. You know, if for instance you find out that a different munition or a different depth was unexpected and found on the site, or you determined a different use, that information can be you can go through the process and identify it and make some changes. So an example for this would be, you know, in the actual module one example we actually have a situation where part of the site it's determined, you know, it ends up being a high density area where it was unexpected to be, and it turns out that it's a former mine site. And so, you know, worksheets are updated, and we sort of walk through what that process would be for you to then, you know, essentially go through a modified data, DQO process, data quality objective process to sort of address that. And you can do that quickly. It doesn't have to take a long time or be overly exhaustive, but just ensure that you are collecting the data you need to then make the determination you did. And like I said, you can look into the actual document, and we walk through that example and sort of have information in there for essentially how data can be recollected and how you can then ensure that you can make the determination. And in that case, right, the goal would be, hey, we went out there, we saw debris on the ground. There's a, you know, there's a former mine shaft opening right here, and we're seeing cultural debris. We see no evidence of munitions. How can we prove it through another round of taking samples so that we can cross that off the list of something for concern? And obviously involving the regulator in that process to make sure you're collecting the requisite amount of information is critical.
Yeah, and I would like to add on to that. I want to remind the group that, you know, the CSM and problem statement and the problem formulation is really the foundation of the DQO process. So we've been discussing throughout this training that there can be changes depending upon what you find during the investigations, changes to the conceptual site model. But if there's major changes to the conceptual site model, then everything subsequent to that is based on your conceptual site model. So if you find a major change that has occurred to the conceptual site model, then your DQO steps that follow that, steps 2 through 4, your data inputs, your limitations, your boundary conditions, all those may no longer be valid. So it means that the tools that we used for the data collection and the criteria and everything else may also no longer be valid, and they may not meet project objectives. So this is why Jordan and I have been emphasizing throughout this training that planning should always involve revisiting that conceptual site model relative to new data and new information to see if any new information is a major change to that conceptual site model or just a minor change. So it should be a team decision and discussed as a project team and decided in terms of whether it's minor or major or requires a revisit of your data quality objectives.
And one thing I just want to add to what Ed said is, you know, I want everyone to sort of have the right context of this. If the conceptual site model initially, we knew everything in the conceptual site model, we wouldn't need to do the study, right? I mean, so the fact that there are unknowns is just a fact, right? I mean, that's why we're conducting the investigation, so that we can actually, you know, to move on through the process. And so, I'm not saying obviously to expect this conceptual site model to be completely wrong, but the fact that you might uncover something that you hadn't anticipated is clearly part of the reason why the investigation is occurring. And so you obviously, and this process obviously allows for you to obviously recover from that and then make adjustments.
Okay. Once again, I'd like to thank Jordan and Ed for their presentation. I think it's very enlightening. We had we had about 95-97% attendance. I think that's outstanding. If you look at the slide we currently have up, just remember April 3rd, Lessons Learned and Issues with the REO Tool by Carrie Meyer. She is going to be hosting that one. That's out for registration. Make sure you get signed up for that. And then a little bit later this year, start looking at September 18th for CWM Response with the NIOC. And with that, I will conclude our presentation, and I'll turn that back over to Jean.
All right, thank you so very much. Let me just walk through a few final reminders before we go ahead and close things out for today's session. I do want to echo thanks for all of those participants who were able to join us in today's live broadcast. A number of you were looking for copies of the presentation materials, and I'll just remind you that content is already posted. It's available on the seminar homepage. If you look on the links on the middle right of your screen, you'll see things that are labeled seminar resources. If you click that link and then press the browse to button, that page will open up, and you can actually access the presentation content as well as a link to the QAP toolkit that was referenced on the DNIC site. Contact information for our presenters and organizers can also be found off of that seminar homepage. You're certainly welcome to reach out to us if you have additional questions or comments. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form. I sit there and read every single one of the responses and then pass on the summaries to your organizers. So I encourage you to complete that form to help continue the delivery of these types of free online events. But another motivator for completing that form, one of the most common questions we get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we do not distribute those credit hours for our webinars, we will supply you with a participation certificate after you fill out that feedback form. Just be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form that certifies you were here for the entire session or replayed the whole thing. And then when you submit it, you'll immediately have access to a PDF file that you can either save or print out for your own records. If you participated in a group, each one of you can fill out that feedback form on your own, whether you registered individually or not, and get your own participation certificate for your own records. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the links on the middle right of the screen to seminar feedback and fill that out based off of your replay to get a participation certificate. As I have noted, the session was recorded, and you will automatically receive an email once that archive is available for on-demand playback. So as Jeff noted, the seminar series will carry on with their April 3rd delivery. Registration is open. You'll see that link again on the middle right of your screen. So I want to thank our organizers and presenters for taking time out of their busy schedules to offer today's session. I want to thank those of you who worked through any